Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another exciting guest this week, the fourth highest rated player in the Netherlands. He's a perennial member of the Olympiad team since 2006, the Netherlands Olympiad team, that is, of course, the 2015 Reykjavik Open champion and a leading open theoretician who has helped former FIDE world champion Topalov and these days works with a certain super GM by the name of Anish Giri, the Dutch number one. Oh, and he's also a Chessable author. Last year, he published Dubov's Tirage, and in recent weeks, he's released Lifetime Repertoire's The Karo Khan. It has 800 trainable variations, 36 hours of video, and in preparation for this interview, I have memorized the whole thing. Just kidding, but we are going to talk about it, and I did buy it and check it out, and it is an impressive piece of work, so I'm eager to dive in and talk about the course and about our guest's career more generally. So let's bring him in. Grandmaster Erwin Lamy, how are you on this fine Thursday as we record?
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me. It's quite an introduction there. yes, great to be here. I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. So you've been in like a 3-month rabbit hole making this course, from what I can gather. I saw a little interview you did on Chess24 about it. It's been keeping you busy, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I came back from the Kinderreis tournament with Anish Giri. That was the beginning of March. And then, of course, everything stopped. Everything came to a standstill, no tournaments. Well, I'm a professional chess player, so I had basically no work on hand. So I completely dove into this project, the lifetime repertoire of the Karo Khan. And it's been, I don't think I've ever worked as hard on a chess project as this one, I must say. It's, it got completely out of hand, basically. I had nothing else to do, so it's all I did for the past 3 months, including the recording. But it was a great thing to do. I discovered a lot of things about the opening that I didn't know before, and I hope people will appreciate the product that went out finally.
Yeah. And so was this project already in the making when coronavirus hit, or did you just start from scratch at that point?
Yeah, we did already have it planned, but suddenly a lot of time also opened up to actually make this course happen. So, it got speed up a little bit, the whole project.
Yeah. And I do think good timing for you personally in terms of being stuck at home, but also I feel like the Karo Khan, at least at my level, I'm about 2150 FIDE, and I feel like I face it a lot in Blitz. I feel like you correctly identified a popular opening that might be a little undercovered.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a very popular opening because from the very first move, e4, c6, you create this imbalanced position, basically. Immediately you give white some space and you try to act accordingly. And it's a very popular opening on amateur level. So on top of that, it wasn't yet covered on chessable to the extent that it is now. So I thought it just had to be it had to be unchessable, basically. So
yeah, and you got the lifetime repertoire tag, well deserved, with as many hours of video and variations as you're providing.
Yeah, no, like I said, initially I didn't think it would become this big, but given that I had 3 months, I just decided. I mean, I gave all kinds of alternative variations. For example, in the advanced variation, I give on move 3 both bishop f5 and c5 as options. In the classical variation, I give both bishop f5 and knight f6 on move 4 as alternatives. So there's actually some ways for the student to mix it up a little bit, to change lines, because it's a lifetime repertoire. You don't want to play the same thing over and over. You become a bit of a target. So I decided I have a lot of time anyway. Let me also give some alternatives. And so it became much bigger than I anticipated at first.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you're, excuse me, I saw that you mentioned that it can be good not to be sort of a sitting duck in terms of which line you play as part of the rationale for suggesting these different moves. So how is the Carol Kahn doing, like, on a theoretical basis? Like, what was the sort of bottom line discovery of all these lines? Or was Black getting pretty good positions?
Yeah, I think theoretically speaking, there it's always been around Caracol. I mean, if you look historically, Botvinnik used it in his World Championship matches with Smyslov, with Tal. I mean, Karpov played it his entire career. I mean, it's an opening that has proven itself, and it's just one of those mainstream big openings that will never be refuted or anything like that. It, of course, had times where it was more or less popular. But theoretically speaking, it's always been doing fine. I think the most recent discovery is in the classical variation. For listeners who are not known for that's a line with knight c3 on move three. There, after taking only four, knight f6 is an old line, of course. But recently, it's been actually been rediscovered, and that seems to be doing very fine for Black as well. That's one of the main new discoveries in this opening, I would say.
Okay, yeah, and you mentioned in the intro you used, of course, Stockfish and Lila, and you said Lila had a lot of interesting discoveries in your research.
Yeah, that's just fantastic. I don't know if people are aware, but Lila has been such a joy to work with in general, and especially in combination with Stockfish, you have the perfect analysis tool. You have, on the one hand, Stockfish, who just calculates everything, makes sure nothing is blundered, make sure that technically speaking everything is fine. And then you have Lila, who constantly comes up with interesting ideas. They might be flawed sometimes, but they're always interesting. They give a very human feel to an analysis, even though it of course goes greatly beyond what we are capable of. But it has this very natural feel to it, how Lila plays, and this combination of Lila with a lot of ideas, a lot of more understanding of certain structures, also closed positions. Lila plays them much better. French structures, for example, Lila is much better than Stockfish. Yeah, that combination of those two engines, that really, I think, if you want to make chess product now, you need those two engines. Otherwise, you're just missing out on, yeah, you'll miss key ideas that are already out there if you use those engines.
And for someone doing research at the level that you are, because I finally, shout out to John Hartman from US Chess, who helped me set up Lila on my computer, and he put out a video for US Chess showing how you can set it up, anyone with a PC and Chessbase. I mean, I know for someone like you, it's probably not rocket science, but I needed a little help. So do you run the engines concurrently, and how long are you letting the engines run? How long would you recommend letting the engines run? What advice would you give to us slightly more casual chess players?
Yeah, it's of course, the question is who is working on chess. For example, okay, I'm a second of Anish Giri. And before I worked with Topalov, you already mentioned that. And as such, computers in my house are running 24/7, more or less. They never stop. So there's always some position running. There's always, there are always ideas, new ideas popping up, new games. And those positions, those games are always tested. So I always have something right now during this conversation. My engine is calculating something, and that never really stops. But for an amateur, I guess, because we speak mostly about opening preparation here, I guess for an amateur, it's much more important to find positions that you like, that fit your style, that. And I don't think it's so much about running your engines 24/7 and trying to memorize 100,000 moves. I think that requires a bit of a different approach. But each his own, of course. If you, as an amateur player, like to explore opening variations and you feel you get better doing that, then there's nothing wrong with that. Obviously, I think there are many ways to try and work on your chess. But let's say the way I do it as a second, that may not be the way for many other people. I would estimate.
So how many computers do you have, Erwin?
Right now, just two, actually. But I also use some from the cloud time to time. So it's crazy. It can get pretty crazy. Yeah.
I bet. And are you on the computer that we're doing this interview? Are you running an engine or is it just on your other one?
No, this is actually, this one is just now silent. The other one is now running. Yeah. No, because it can make a lot of noise, actually, this one.
Yeah. I went to visit John Edwards, who's one of the leading correspondence players in the world. Turns out he lives not far from me. So right before the coronavirus, I went to see his house and got a little bit of a sort of a glimpse behind the curtain. He's got like the cooling fan and, you know, this however many cores machine that also he's just crunching some position, you know, as you say, 24/7.
You probably don't need heating in your house anymore. If you're
right, exactly.
Because to be honest, this my computer, I'm sitting in my guest room right now, which is sort of guest room / studio / whatever it is, and there's one computer here, and it's a relatively small room, and if it starts really running, it gets incredibly warm in this room. So you really don't need heating much, I think, if you have 5-6 computers running at home as a correspondence player. I'm sure that he has a very warm house.
Yeah, that's crazy. And sometimes you need it here. When you're running these engines, are you typically, like, would it be, you know, you saw some game yesterday that piqued your interest in a given position? Or are you working, aside from when you're doing a course like this for Chessable, are you working on a specific line for Anish at a certain time and kind of digging into that and then going on to the next one? Or is it more just what piques your curiosity?
It can be anything, actually. It can be indeed. It can be Anish writing me a message like, "Oh, have you seen this?" And then just start. But for example, for the past 3 months, because the candidates have been, we're not sure when it will start again. There aren't really many events happening online. Obviously, there's a lot happening, but let's say the preparation usually goes into the big. How to call them these days, over the board events. For me as a second, not much work needed to be done in the past few months. So that's why I actually, all the computer time went into my courses, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because Anish, of course, legendary opening theoretician as well. That's one thing I've heard speculated about on the various broadcasts is, the top level players, are they using their prep or are they kind of just keeping it on the back burner because they're playing so much chess right now with all these rapid events? So basically you're not like sending Anish stuff for every game 15 game that he's playing.
We are always in touch, but you shouldn't forget that Anish is himself probably I would say he's probably the biggest opening expert in the world right now. And that's mostly him. I mean, that is 99% him. I'm trying to help him a bit.
Right.
But he has this incredible overview of opening variations, much better than me. I mean, I cannot even compare in that sense. So it's for me, it's mostly during tournaments, especially. I'm trying to help him. I when he goes to sleep, I check certain positions deeper. But he really is in charge generally. So it's not like I'm the one feeding him with everything he knows. He is still working and he's still finding new things and he's still implementing them also in the online events. But it's mostly absolutely him in general. I want to definitely stress that, not to make my own role too big here, because that would be really a wrong thing to think. Yeah,
we don't want Anish to hear this interview and think you're taking all the credit.
No. Exactly. Yeah.
And of course. And you can see it in interviews with him that he really does. Like he just loves it. Like I know he's said stuff like whether it was his job or not, he would just be doing chess all the time. And I think that's part of the reason that he's able to do such in-depth preparation. But one thing that I wonder about is how he remembers all this stuff. I mean, okay, he must have an amazing memory to begin with. But do you guys have any secret tricks that you can share? Is there any method, or is it just sort of come naturally to him?
Yeah, these top guys, they are of course quite gifted in that way. That makes me kind of jealous at time. I mean, I remember when we were preparing for the World Championship match with Anand, Topalov had a certain game plan against one e4. Which finally didn't happen at all in the match, but he had a plan, and he actually didn't want to spend too much time on that. He just felt that it's fine, and we're not really going to focus much on it. But I felt it's a bit weird because we're going to go for a World Championship match, and I said that at the very least, send me those files that you have, the opening work. And I will just sort of rehearse you. I will ask you some questions like I was. And he, I'm pretty sure he hadn't seen those files in a very long time, maybe even 1-2 years or something like that. And I started asking him these questions from the file. So he was sitting behind the board. I'm sitting behind the screen. And I'm taking random positions from a file with thousands of moves, including very obscure sidelines within those files. And he was banging it out without thought, all the moves, including comments like, well, I first thought that this was the right move, but then I changed my mind to this. And it was incredible. I never saw something like it. And then I also realized that why he's so much stronger. Right. Because I have very embarrassing moments when I'm working with Anish. I send him a file with work. And 3 months later, for example, he tells me like, yeah, by the way, that line, this and this and this is an update. Sometimes I don't even know what line he speaks about. I just cannot recall even the work that I because there's just so much. But yeah, I think it just comes by nature. I don't have anything. I mean, from my experience, at least with Topalov and Anish, they're just very gifted with an extremely good memory.
And a lot, of course, has come out in recent years about that match between Topalov and Anand, especially from the Anand side, with him writing Mind Masters and the book by F.M. Michael Oblin, The Anand Files. And I got to do a really fun interview with Peter Hein Nielsen. So are you able to say what he had planned for against E4? Like, are you able to say with a little more detail what he had in mind?
Yeah, he was just going to go Knight-F.
Okay. Yeah. Just hearing it, that would have been my guess.
I didn't mention in the opening, but I don't think 10 years afterwards.
Okay. Yeah, and he doesn't even play that much these days.
Exactly. No. So that and he. Yeah. Okay. He knew those. He knew that opening inside out. He was just.
Yeah.
It was incredible. Okay, it's really his opening, of course. It's clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it was a stylistic.
It was a great book, by the way, by Michiel Abon. He really.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, and also. Well, of course, for Team Topalov, let's say, the match had a bit of a bitter end. But, there were a lot of nice memories, of course. It's still, today, I consider it one of my most, cherished memories when it comes to chess. I mean, to be part of a World Championship match, playing it, it became quite clear that I was not going to do that anytime soon. So right. this is about as close as you can get, and it was a great experience. I mean, for about 2-3 months or so, we were really completely into this match, and it looked initially very good for Topalov as well, winning the first game in great style. But then things went the way they went. But this is some great memories anyway, despite, of course, the outcome.
Yeah. And in reading that book, was there anything that particularly surprised you, having been on the other side of that match in particular?
It surprised me how many things you forget, actually, over time. I mean, I went through the book, and I even certain games, they were already kind, they kind of faded already. And yeah, it was just great to recollect actually many many things. And also, I read certain things that you, yeah, you know how we perceived it, and it's just very interesting how that. Yeah, the World Championship match, it's of course the most interesting chess event there is. I think a lot of talk is always about how should the match be 12 games, 14 games, 16 games. They're always complaining, too many draws, etc. But I think at the end of the day, the World Championship match is still by far the most watched chess event there is, and everybody is usually enjoying it.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sympathetic to the arguments. I saw you say somewhere in an interview that you miss OTB chess and classical chess, as it were. And I'm more of a fan of this move online. I like the fast games, but I heard someone like Daryl Morey, the general manager of the Houston Rockets and the basketball league here in the U.S., he's a big chess fan, and he did like a Q&A with Hikaru Nakamura. And he was saying that as an outsider, one thing that really surprises him is he considers the World Championship cycle to seem a little sort of convoluted and outdated with these long matches, and like you get the title and then you just sit on it. He was saying like it doesn't really work like that in other sports, and he's not sure if it should still work that way. And even though I'm probably a little more progressive than a lot of chess fans in terms of my opinion about stuff that could be changed, when I heard that and I started to think about the idea of changing the World Championship format, the classical match, I can't let go. There's so much history.
No, because that was going to be my answer, my question actually. Then how should it then look? Because I think we should be very careful to throw away that legacy with those matches. With those, I mean, it's something that really worked for a very long time. And even for example, chess in the Netherlands, it's relatively small right now, I'm afraid. But it's always during World Championship matches that journalists start calling me for comments on the match. Dutch journalists, because they see that the World Championship match is ongoing, and it's one of the few events where actually media etc. they still pay attention to this. It's one of the few occasions I think when chess still reaches the limelight.
Yeah, I mean, Magnus has floated ideas, and my friend Greg Shahadi, not to compare him to Magnus, but he also has obviously been a vocal proponent of blending in faster chess. So I know that people make the arguments that you could have like a mixed event for the World Championship where it's like some classical, some rapid, and some blitz, and maybe you even weight the classical more heavily, but you do like a combined score. But I don't know. I still like the.
No, I'm actually not at all opposing all of this. Not at all. But it's just that I'm. Yeah, I feel a bit for those matches. I have a soft spot for those.
Yeah, as you should.
It would be hard for me to just abandon them on a whim and say like, let's try something new. So it would have to be something really good, I think, to replace those. The way it is now. But I do agree. I mean, it's true. Yeah, the world champion, he just waits until somebody qualifies. It's a little bit outdated, probably. But as long as we have nothing better, I would be very...
Yeah. Well, if anything, I miss the one-on-one matches of like the historic candidate cycle where you start with, 16 people and then you get down to 8 and they play one-on-one. Like, I actually prefer that to the one tournament, whoever does well in that one tournament. I mean, of course, there's the qualification process, so not just anyone can get in. But I miss, like, the match format generally I find to be very compelling.
Yeah, that's definitely also an idea. I mean, the real candidate matches. Yeah, we of course had a little in 2011, I think it was, in Kazan. There were matches as well. There was the problem was that the tournament wasn't very successful. I don't know if you recall that one where Gelfand won it, but generally it was considered that there were a lot of short draws in that tournament. I remember these matches between Radjabov and Kramnik, and Grishuk and Kramnik, and people were very disappointed in that event. Okay. And maybe that didn't help in reinstating those old matches. I was actually there with Toprov still at the time, 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to get back to your course in a bit, or, and we have a listener question about it, but hearing you talk about going to the candidates and you're having mentioned earlier that you went with Anish to Ekaterinburg, I had the privilege of interviewing GM Rustam Kazymzhanov, who talked a little bit about what it was like to be there with Fabi. And I found it fascinating given the circumstances around coronavirus. And I wasn't aware that you had been there as well, although certainly not shocked. Could you tell us a little bit about just the day-to-day experience of playing in those extremely, coaching, training in those extremely unusual circumstances?
Yeah, it was special, of course. When we left the Netherlands, it was really early March because we went quite a few days before the tournament. And of course, there was already very serious, Corona was already around. But I have to be honest, at the time, I wasn't yet fully understanding the situation, let's say. So we left still relatively relaxed to Yekaterinburg. And the thing is that the moment we arrived there, we, of course, decided to just focus on the event. And basically, what I told Anish is that we should just try to sort of stay in a bubble from now on. I mean, we're here. We're going to play this tournament, so we may as well just ignore all news on because we're here anyway. I mean, it's just gonna, we're gonna start playing now, and that's what we did, and we did it quite successfully actually. Despite, I mean, it's surprisingly, I mean, if I tell you now that in the morning after breakfast we had to go to the doctor, he would measure the temperature. Then in the evening after the game we would do the same. Surprisingly, that gets very normal after a couple of days. You just get used to that. And yeah, we just got into this routine of breakfast, doctor, back to the room, preparing, making a walk, playing the game. And it actually surprised us very much when the tournament suddenly ended. We hadn't seen that coming at all. We were thinking, because we were completely in our own bubble. Of course, afterwards, when you come back to the Netherlands and see the real scale of things, we maybe shouldn't have started playing at all, of course, but yeah, that's in hindsight.
Okay, so to you, did it, I mean, there were interviews with Alexander Grishuk and others talking about sort of how surreal the whole experience was, but it sounds like for you and GM Geary, you guys were able to establish enough of a routine where it didn't feel all that strange.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. I mean, we really made a conscious decision that okay, we are here now, and there's a spot for the match at stake, and we're just gonna try to close ourselves for everything, all the outside news. Also trusting, of course, the organizers in that sense. I mean, when we arrived, we had a technical meeting with the FIDE president, who assured us, spoke to us about all the measures that were in place, etc. And okay, we decided, okay, we'll trust the procedure, and we'll just go along with it. Yeah, and then okay, the airspace got closed, and the tournament was ended.
So do you think that really was the reason? Because others have intimated that there may have been other reasons at play for shutting down.
Yeah, I cannot really comment because I heard those rumors, but it actually seemed like a very reasonable reason to stop a tournament because if we cannot get out anymore, then it's a bit of an issue. I mean, at the moment that we're talking, it's still closed, right? The airspace. So we're almost 4 months later now. So I think that was probably the right decision to do. But I don't know the ins and outs of what happened behind the scenes, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it's those who know don't tell. And it could be that it was those were the reasons, you know, who knows? So, but in any event, I mean, I don't think it was like with the outsider's perspective, with sort of the world grinding to a halt as that tournament continued. It wasn't such a shock that it was stopped. It was more of a shock that it was going to begin with.
And also in hindsight, if I look back at the whole period, I mean, I completely understand that people were thinking that way. It's just that, I'm trying to explain our perspective of things, that we went there in a moment that Corona already was around, obviously. but we were still, we could travel, we could take the plane there. There were no restrictions on the plane at all. We could just, everything was going relatively normally. And then we arrived in Yekaterinburg and we just went into tournament mode. And so our experience wasn't as maybe as surreal as others. I had also that feeling, actually, you could see that in post-game interviews, that some players were extremely uncomfortable during the tournament. But, you would have to ask Anish over there, but I was there with him the entire time. It felt to me like he was just doing his thing there.
Okay. Huh. Yeah, and of course I have to ask, everyone's wondering what they're going to do now. Obviously they announced it won't be happening anytime soon, the resuming of the candidates, which MVL and Nepomniachtchi lead, and Anish is a point back, right?
The eighth round is going to be very interesting because Anish plays Nepomniachtchi and MVL plays with Caruana.
Wow.
Or both. I mean, Anish and Caruana both 1 point behind. So it's going to be very interesting when it opens again. It's going to be huge clashes basically immediately.
Yeah, and yeah, those will be some high level prep for those games.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you have you heard anything, or did you have a preference about all the discussions about how to resume the tournament and about like making amends for Rajabov having been lost his spot?
Yeah, that is such a tough situation because we, of course, the tournament started, and I agree the way that happened with Rajabov, that didn't deserve the beauty prize, of course. So I'm assuming that behind the scenes they've already been talking. I liked that Rajabov competed in the Nations Cup, which I thought was maybe some kind of peace offering from both sides. So I have no idea. I'm just speculating here.
Right.
Nations Cup, of course, organized by FIDE. So I thought that maybe that would be nice if in some way or another he would be compensated. And yeah, it also showed that the chess world is not really, chess players are not really united. Yeah, in such cases. Yeah, you would think that maybe the players would come together and decide on things, but that, yeah, it's a very individual sport. But maybe that's normal. I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, as I had asked Rustam, if the players had been able to come together, it could have been that the tournament could have been delayed to begin with.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course, the players in that sense have enormous power. I saw a interview, I think, in passing from Emil Sutovsky, I think, who mentioned September, October as a possible, but I didn't hear anything about that after that.
Yeah,
those dates, but it's all I know as much as anyone else. I think I'm also not, but I would be very reluctant to go back to Yekaterinburg right now, at least. I don't know. I mean, I'm very curious how that's gonna play out, but I would be surprised if it's gonna be held in the same place in September. It sounds very optimistic to me, but
yeah, it does. And now that they've already announced the World Championship won't be until 2021, you know, at best.
Yeah, there isn't much of a rush, actually.
Right.
I also think that having stopped the first event, they really want to finish it this time. So I think they should just. Make sure that they get it in a safe place, perhaps even outside of Russia. I also wouldn't be surprised if they would try to hold the second stage elsewhere, maybe in a country where things are going relatively well in terms of Corona. But it's all speculation. I obviously don't know.
So it won't be the United States.
No, probably not.
Yeah, unfortunately, but true.
Yeah.
Thank you for being willing to talk about that. I get the sense that it's a sensitive topic just because, you know, the chess world is so small that, you know, decisions were taken and we may not agree with them all. But at some point, it's not necessarily beneficial to sort of shoot arrows at each other.
Yeah, no, also definitely not. I mean, I still don't. I mean, I guess in hindsight, it wasn't a good thing to do. But at the time, to be honest, I thought it was a pretty brave decision by FIDE to just say, like, okay, I think we can do this, and let's get on with it. And if it's really the airspace that stopped it, yeah, that is a case of very bad luck, I guess. Although, once again, in hindsight, it's all very normal that it stopped. And I still don't know. I'm on the fence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your work with Anish, because he's been really, as I saw you mention in the Chess 24 broadcast, you hopped in and did some announcing with Yasser Sarawan, and Jan Gustafsson came on, and you're a natural announcer. It was fun to watch. And one of the things you said is that Anish has been working on his fast chess, which of course is evident in his results. But that got me wondering how a player of that caliber, is there something he does besides just play to work on his fast chess?
Yeah, it's very interesting because, I don't know, listeners might know, Anish has been, of course, always playing the Grand Chess Tour as one of the top 10 players. And the Grand Chess Tour initially was a classical event, so only classical tournaments with classical time control, that is. And then they made a bit of a switch to add Rapid and Blitz as well. And that was never really Anish's his strong suit. So he had a lot of events in the Grand Chess Tour where he would just basically be slaughtered in those Rapid and Blitz events. So at some point, he simply had enough of this, which makes sense, of course, because you're also meeting those same opponents in classical events, and it's annoying, of course, to have to not be able to compete with them with Rapid and Blitz events, which are happening more and more these days. So he made a conscious decision to work on that, and I think it already showed towards the end of the previous tour. He did quite well in the Rapid and Blitz event in India, for example. In Romania, he also did not so bad. And when Corona hit, he decided to just start playing Blitz and Bullet a lot online, which is a type of game he really rarely plays. And it really worked out for him well, I think. I mean, he's become much more practical, much faster, much trickier, all those things you need for online chess. So I think it worked out well for him. I'm actually very curious to see now how it will also translate to a quick play over the board, so to speak. But online, it's already, I mean, I really think he's now among the very best in Blitz as well online.
Yeah, and even Magnus was quite complimentary. We'll get to the relationship of Magnus and Anish in a little bit. But so does, I mean, Anish, of course, you mentioned his legendary opening knowledge. So obviously he's like an engine guy. Does he play against the engines, or does he have secret accounts online? What's going on behind the scenes?
I think playing against engines is something that is really never really done by top players, because it's just, you don't really take much from it. And it's kind of humiliating as well. No, of course, what is done, Anish regularly meets with people online, strong players, plays Blitz matches with them, just sharpening his skills, so to speak. And that's been really working. And that's something he of course, would always do, I mean, throughout his entire career, but he really put much more emphasis on that this time and in these past few months and already before that. If you see the games, I thought most striking was his the semi-final he had with Nepomniachtchi in the Chessable Masters. In that final blitz game, he had, I think, around 50 seconds on the clock, and Nepo makes a move by which he basically throws everything at Anish's king, and Anish to find just two very cool moves. Very calm moves, but very hard to find with 50 seconds on the clock. Somebody's throwing his pieces at your king, and you just make two very calm moves, and actually turns out there's nothing happening. And I'm pretty sure that half a year ago, or maybe a bit longer, Anish, I mean, it sounds bad maybe, but I'm not sure he would have been that same calm, collected guy who would have just found those moves over the board, which he did now in the match against Nepo. But I think through all those bullet games, blitz games, he got used to being under time pressure, under pressure from tricky moves, etc. And he became much more practical that way. So he just found those practical skills to find the solution there. I really think that in that game you see the direct conversion from all that work he did before the events in the actual game. And I thought that was really a highlight for me actually.
Yeah. And just one more, sorry to keep asking you about Anish, because I know you have quite a distinguished career in your own right.
I understand, of course.
So with these blitz games, is he analyzing the blitz games, do you know, or is it just more just get the reps in of playing against other top players and just keep going?
The training games or?
Yeah.
I think if you play blitz online, which in the old times was always considered a very bad thing to do, I think that's not really the case, but okay. But I do think that at least you should make some thoughts on what you have just done. So right. Even if it's just briefly scrolling with an engine through the move, seeing where you blundered something, maybe there was a moment in the game where you were like, I thought I was better there, but I didn't see how. Then it's nice to, then you take something from such games, I think. And in the meantime, you are, by playing Blitz, you're sharpening all those skills that you, especially in those online events that you really need.
Gotcha. Yeah, and you're a pretty strong Blitz player in your own right, and Bullet as well. So what advice would you give generally to, you just gave some, but is there anything else you would advise for people? I feel like even at the club level now, there's more of an emphasis of people are like, oh man, I want to sharpen up my faster games.
Yeah, it sounds maybe a bit obvious, but I think what Anish did, he just started playing a lot of online chess. Bullet especially, I used to think that cannot be useful in any possible way, but I see him simply being, like I said, faster, trickier, more practical with his time, everything. So even I think his bullet games helped him to an extent. I think all those classical methods of improving your game, I mean, what I'm saying now here, Botvinnik would probably tell me I lost my mind. But yeah, from what I'm seeing Anish playing these bullet games and what I see from him now, what he shows in practice, it seems to have paid off. So I would just encourage people to start playing online.
Yeah.
Think through. And then, of course, well, there's the famous Chess at 99% tactics, which is probably also true. Maybe it's even 100% tactics, especially at a certain level. I think it's more or less everything is decided by tactics. So, yeah, training your tactics is of course, always a good thing to do. That is that always helps.
Yeah, and Botvinnik, of course, famously not a big advocate of playing Blitz.
Yeah, I said that. Yeah, Botvinnik was, of course, big. There's this famous story of Botvinnik where he's asked if he ever played a Blitz game, and he says something like, in 1938 on a train once. It's like,
right, yeah.
Not a big fan of Blitz.
Yeah, but in those days, there was no instant engine analysis. I mean, that just changes the whole paradigm.
Yeah, and they would play with 2.5 hours for the first, 30 moves, and they would adjourn.
Yeah.
It's completely different times. You cannot compare anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. So we alluded a minute ago to the back and forth between Magnus Carlsen and Anish Giri on Twitter. I think a lot of listeners, even those not on Twitter, will have heard about it by now. But we got a few questions from Patreon supporters of the show related to it, of course. It's a topic of much interest to us chess fans. So I don't know what you can say, how involved in this you even are, Erwin, but I'll at least ask the questions and then you can say as much or as little as you want. So this is from friend of the show, Peter Newhall, who asks, and actually I think I'll just read both questions at once because they're kind of related. Both friends of the show, Peter Newhall and Han Schut. Peter asks, do you feel like the online beef in quotes with Carlsen in his seconds is ultimately motivating or distracting? It often seems like it's all in good fun only to push past that, which seems to be happening more and more frequently. And then from Han Schut, do you think that the Twitter banter between Magnus Carlsen and Anish Giri is just innocent trolling, or that Magnus is doing it for psychological domination of my boy, again in quotes, Anish Giri, as Magnus calls him?
Yeah, it's very interesting because we just spoke about the Chessable Masters where I did the commentary. I joined Yasser Seidemann and Anna Rudolph for one day. I filled in. And at some point, Anna Rudolph started describing the Twitter rivalry, and she quoted all kinds of tweets. And then at some point, it was brought to me because they obviously thought that I'm going to be now the one,
right,
to say how it is. But and then it was a bit embarrassing because I have a Twitter account. I quite frequently even, but I really don't follow it that much. So. I heard tweets from Anna that day that I had never heard or seen before.
Okay.
So I think I got away with it, but yeah, it was tough because I really didn't know what all the Twitter beef was about. So I cannot comment too much, but I do feel that that's more, I think, relates to the second question about psychology in the game. And that I think definitely exists and maybe even sometimes expands to places like Twitter. Like, for example, I think even listeners who play in their local club, they will have some rivalry with certain people there, and in analysis they might try to outwit them or outsmart right. them. Even on every level, I think that happens. And with those top 10 players, they are meeting each other like all year long. They're playing 10, 15 games against each other every year in certain years. They're playing matches against each other like Carlsen and Caruana did, for example. So there is definitely some psychological things happening there, obviously. And that's certainly interesting. And it's also interesting to think like why does that top player play less good against that top player, but not against this one. It's also often there's a lot of psychology involved, and it's not always chess that is the leading factor there. But getting back to Twitter, I honestly don't know how to assess it. I think it could be just sometimes I'm sure it's good fun. Sometimes maybe it gets a little bit more heated than that. But in general, there is some psychology involved in all of this. I'm pretty sure of that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, because that's sort of my impression about it sort of ebbing and flowing in terms of degrees of intensity. Because, you know, I mean, they obviously see each other all the time, Anish and Magnus. And generally, it sort of seemed maybe a touch personal for a while. And then it seemed very good hearted. And of course, Anish is doing all these Chess24 and Chessable events. I mean, there's no level of animosity that's like costing him business opportunities, as far as I can tell.
You saw, for example, in the Chessable Masters after the final game, they both came on the show, and I felt that was actually great to watch. That was not the day that I was commenting. There was another, so I could just watch from home, and they were both commenting on the games, and I people really loved how they were interacting, and very respectful. I mean, it's not like there's definitely no hate there or something. I don't know what people are looking for, and there's definitely a lot of respect back and forth. But yeah, maybe sometimes a bit of banter gets a bit heated. But I mean, seeing them there after that final game in the Chessable Masters, I don't think that much is really wrong between them.
Okay, that's good to hear.
My current verdict. It can change any day, of course.
Right.
New tweet. Yeah. Out, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, it seems that it does change frequently, but we're glad to have Anish. I mean, Magnus hops in every once in a while, but Anish is the one that's like super active on Twitter and sort of driving the conversation, which ultimately, you know, despite maybe a few ruffled feathers one way or the other, is good for promoting chess and gives us something to talk about.
Yeah, I've been asked about it a lot, so I guess it really is something that people like. Yeah, personally, like I said, yeah, I definitely miss more than half of the tweets that are sent back and forth, so I'm not the best judge.
Okay, so Erwin, you ready to talk a little bit of chess improvement?
Of course, always.
Okay, so let's take a break. Of course, we're going to run an ad for your course for Chessable, but I'll take a quick break and then we'll get to it, all right? As you can tell from this interview, Grandmaster Erwin Lamy knows his openings inside and out and has put in a ton of work to the new Chessable course, Lifetime Repertoires Karo Khan. 36 hours of videos if you get the video course, 800 trainable variations if you just get the non-video course, and there's even a free short and sweet Karo Khan course if you just want to go check it out and see what it's all about. And remember that Chessable.com has the Move Trainer technology that uses spaced repetition to make sure that you really learn all of the great material in all of their courses, including this one. So it's on sale right now. So go to Chessable.com and have a look at Grandmaster Lamy's Lifetime Repertoires Karo Khan. Okay, so Erwin, again, in the recent Chess 24 print interview that I mentioned before, you mentioned that you read a lot of chess books. You said you liked On the Origin of Good Moves. What else are you into? Are you reading all the time in between having the engines running, or just like when something piques your interest?
Yeah, I'm completely into chess books from early age already. So everything that comes out, I just we're just lacking space already here. We have a decent sized apartment, but we already have to find creative places where to place the books because I'm really enjoying. I'm reading constantly. Actually, not only chess books, also novels, everything. But on the Origin, actually, he was your guest recently, Willy Hendricks.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, I really loved his book. I think that's the type of book that I'm looking for. That makes you think and reevaluate certain things because the way he describes the history of the game. And I don't know if you want to do that, redo that, but I'll do a little advertisement for his book because I really think he did a great. He completely made me rethink the entire history of the game, because I had this classic notion of romantic era where people could only sacrifice, give mate, and then somewhere when Steinitz came, we all started to suddenly understand that there's more to chess. He really does a very compelling job describing the history a little bit differently in a bit more measured way. I think he's right, simply from what I'm seeing. And I actually started browsing through games, and also after I finished his book, I started checking games from those times. And indeed, they're kind of normal games, but of course on a lower level because they were just developing the game basically.
Yeah, we're referring, of course, to I Am Willy Hendricks, and you can hear his interview was about a month to 6 weeks back on the show. If any listeners didn't catch it. So what other books, whether it be chess or novels, what else have you read that you enjoyed recently, Erwin?
I'm reading Thomas Mann's book. I don't know the English translation. It's about... what's the English translation? Oh, that's very embarrassing. I read it in Dutch. So but it's about a person going to quarantine, actually. So I thought it was a very fitting... I went into the bookshop here, the local bookshop, and they actually had it on offer as sort of...
Of course, yeah.
So I thought it was a fitting... Magical Mountain or something? Could that be?
Okay. Normally, I would quickly look it up on my phone, but okay, my daughter ran away with it.
it's a very nice book. I didn't finish it yet, but I will one of these days. It's very, very enjoyable. Yeah, very interesting. Also, it's about the concept of time and how in different situations you perceive it very differently. When you are in time pressure, time is different. Let me just bring it back to chess. When you're in time trouble, time is different than when you have 2 hours on the clock. You perceive it. And he plays with that whole concept very, very nicely, I think, throughout the book.
Interesting. Yeah, I I like fiction generally, but you only have so much time to read, so I often gravitate towards nonfiction. But I think fiction's having a renaissance during Corona because people are just like, I want to think about something else, you know, take me to another place.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. Yeah, that could very well have been the reason. Yeah, it's maybe subconscious, on a subconscious level. I'm also drawn towards nonfiction generally, but this one really got me. Yeah.
Yeah. And what about chess-wise? What other books of yours are all-time or recent favorites?
The thing is, I got that question at Chess 24. What's your favorite book? And I just couldn't. There are so many. For example, that comes to mind the obvious ones: Zurich 53 from Blomstein, A Test of Time by Kasparov. That one actually, I really, because I got it when I was very young. I really loved that book. But then I also had a Dutch book about all the world champions, and it's nothing special, but I just had it from early childhood, and I just went through those games, and it's so there. I wouldn't be able to choose. So finally, I went with the most recent one that I read and which I really enjoyed, which was Willy Hendricks' his book. Mm-hmm. But there are just so many of them. I liked. I think for people who want to, let's say, get a bit of history of the game as well as get some culture of the game, I think the Kasparov series is great. The predecessor series, it's a bit of a must, I think. it's very hard to choose. What is your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
You know, yeah, it's so hard to pick. To pick one. I mean, I like a lot of the more recent books, I have to say. I mean, I think, you know, I ask this question practically every week, and a lot of people like yourself, they gravitate towards the ones that they read when they were kids, because that evokes a feeling. And it's like when you were hungriest and learning at the fastest pace. For me, that's the first thing I think of, something like My 60 Memorable Games, which I'm going to do a podcast about soon. And I had 500 master games, thick books, you know, and descriptive. But realistically, I feel like the Agard books and the Game Changer and even the Hendrix book, the new ones are just so good. And aside from books, Erwin, we also have the time-tested question of how to divide one's study time. Like, do you have a feeling about, you know, there's, speaking of Willy Hendrix, there's the people who say only do tactics. There's the people who say, you know, you can also read prose books. Do you have a feeling about the best way for club players to get better at chess?
Yeah, it's one of those advices that people will say, like, ah, that's just too easy. But I really believe in it, actually. I think you should just spend your time on chess on an area that you like. I think that from that you gain the most. If you have limited time and you love studying the end game, just study the end game. Why would you then try to waste your time on openings? And if you are really into openings, because I don't see there is one perfect way of working on chess. And I think if you do it smartly, you can learn a lot. For example, we also during the Chess World Masters, we spoke about engines. There's, of course, such strong engines out there these days, and in the past trainers would say things like never use an engine when you're analyzing it. Right. It's ruining your chess, and it was true, because these old engines, like the first versions of Fritz and Junior, they would tactically still outplay humans, but positionally they wouldn't be able to do anything, so you wouldn't actually learn anything from these engines. They would play very ugly moves, and then they would trick you somewhere. That was generally the concept of those engines. But now with Leela and with actually the strongest Stockfish is also extremely good. The latest versions of Stockfish are also extremely strong. They can actually, if you use them wisely, you can really learn from those end games and from those engines. And you should really use them, I think. But of course, not in a passive way. Many people they just put a position on their screen. Then they start their engine. Then they just read out, oh, okay, this is plus minus 2.68. They write it down and they say, I'm winning. They should, of course, ask questions. They should like, wow, why is this move not good? Why is that move? And if you input your own ideas and you get feedback from a strong engine, then I think it's brilliant. And especially with Leela, the engine understands structures, understands maneuvering, understands everything. It's just a fantastic playing machine. So I would also advocate just using those engines, but in the right way. That is, I think, the very important in an active way, in an engaging way.
Yeah, so much comes down to active as compared to passive. No matter what you're doing,
and just do what you enjoy when it comes to chess. I really think I believe in that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think just since so much is unsettled, I think that's the best advice, because...
Exactly. I also don't know, but I know from people I've met throughout my career that more or less everybody had a different approach.
Yeah, exactly. I mean...
And they all got there. They all got there somehow. So yeah. I think as long as you are actively thinking about the game, that's also one of those things that I discovered from top players. When they see a chess position, for example, they pass by an analysis, they immediately switch on. They look at the position. They're on, like they are in an actual game position. For example, someone like Vishyanant is incredibly fast. He immediately spots key things in the position in instantly. And all the top players, they are like that. They're constantly, their head is turned on, so to speak. They're not passive. They're constantly thinking and ready to solve things, and to I think that state of mind is also very important.
Yeah I'm sure I had as many interactions with top players as you, but you do notice that, like, it, you know, if there's a position in a movie like the good chess players are always looking at the position on the board.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah. If you see, for example, Peter Schwittler doing his commentary on chess 24, he's so fast. It goes so easy for him. That's just incredible to watch. I mean, that part of me with the top player who's he has this click, like you turn him on and he just chess machine comes out. It's remarkable to watch. Very enjoyable to
And then meanwhile he's like, oh, I don't know anything about this position. with Schwittler in particular. Yeah,
but start the sentence with, well, I don't really know, but maybe you can do something like this, and then a line comes. And
right.
Everybody's just nodding, like, oh, yeah, that's true.
Right. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. So you mentioned Kasparov, and again, in the Chess24 video, interview, you said he was your favorite player, the test of time. Unfortunately, I mean, a lot of guests have mentioned it. It came out before I was really into chess, and I haven't caught up with it yet. Now it's out of print, so I've been hoping to pay less than $200 for a copy. So I haven't gotten one yet. But you also mentioned in a couple interviews that you were at the Kasparov's most famous game, the 1999 Weekend Z Topalov-Kasparov. Yasser called it the Pearl of Weekend Z. But I was wondering if you could go in a little more detail about being there and watching the game. Like,
I remember it very well because, so in Weekend Z, there is a big playing hall for people who are not familiar with the tournament of Weekend Z. Super tournament, of course, with a huge tradition, 80 plus years already. And so there's a huge playing hall, and about 60%, I would say, of the hall is occupied by amateur players. So there are hundreds of players. And then there is sort of a division, a small wall. A
partition, yeah.
Yeah, partition, yeah. Sorry, I couldn't find the English word.
It's a tough English word.
And then behind that, the Grandmaster groups are playing. There are two Grandmasters groups as well. And as a small child, I was just leaning on this partition, basically. And I was just, I had a good spot, so I could clearly see the game Kasparov Topalov. I even thought at some point, I even caught his eye. And uh-huh. I felt as a child that we had some kind of understanding of what was going on. And I just saw all of it happening. So the rook sacrifice, and of course I didn't want to leave my spot at all. And there were many people gathering at that point. It was fantastic. Of course, internet not that big at that time. Nowadays, of course, online everything is followed to much bigger extent than back then. So there were hundreds of visitors. It's in general a tournament that is very well visited by people. But in my memory, there were hundreds of people gathered that day. Probably that's also just a child's imagination. But that was a fantastic experience. And okay, I already had, from very early age, the test of time. He was the world champion at the time that I was becoming a better player myself. He's one of the best ever, so it's obvious that he had a huge impact. Though stylistically, if you look at my games, it looks like he had no impact at all. But he definitely he's definitely my favorite. Absolutely, yeah.
And there were no, at some of these tournaments, they have the headphones where you can hear announcers. There was none of that, right?
No. It was just me and everybody else leaning on. And there was some whispering.
Right, yeah. So there was a point where you were like, this game is... Right. So you knew it was something special at some point.
To be honest, when he... you could only see it because, we were speaking about psychology before. You could only sense it, or I at least at the time, by how Kasparov was looking, how he was behaving, how he was pacing. It looked, he really felt it, of course, that he's doing something special here. So that's how we realized that something is going on. And the moves were also coming in. Rook takes d4, rook e7 check. I don't know if you recall the exact, but that whole sequence, king rush to a5. Then, of course, we knew that something is really up. Yeah.
Yeah, you're mentioning the psychology, and Kasparov, of course, being famously expressive during his games. We have another question from a Patreon supporter of the show. This is from Craig Mallon, who actually asked, he says, in your experience as a strong player, how much does body language play a role in high-level tournament games? Is having a good poker face important? Do you find yourself studying your opponent's expression, and do you make a conscious effort to mask your own?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm really not sure, to be honest. I mean, Kasparov, you always knew. I mean, I never played Kasparov, obviously. He quit way before I got even close to playing him, so that never happened. But I played, for example, with Carlsen and with Kramnik and with Anand, and they're all so different. Nakamura, they're all playing at the top level. With Kramnik, I always liked that. It's actually a pity I cannot show it to the viewers now. But always when you would make a move, I don't even know if he does it consciously, but he would make a sort of look slightly dismissive, not really obvious, but I never felt good playing him. I played him 2 times, and both times lasted barely 20 moves, I think. So it was a terrible experience. Well, Anand is, just before resigning, I realized that his facial expression, nothing actually had actually changed throughout his entire game. With Magnus, it's a little bit more obvious when he feels relieved or relaxed or when he feels good about it. I always could sense somehow when he would feel good about his position. Not that he does it, I think, purposely or something, but I could sense it. And the most, I think the hardest player to read, and I think more people have mentioned this, is Mickey Adams from the English top player. He is simply, you don't know whether he's winning or losing. It could be either, it can be either way. He's completely, unreadable. I myself haven't really worked on this or trying to cover my own way. I think it would be very energy consuming to try and mask what you are thinking or what you are. And it's not like in poker that you're really giving away too much. I think, I mean, it's usually both, especially on a certain level, both players know what is generally going on or what they think is going on. And some bluffing probably happens, but generally people consciously make the decision to hide things during a game. Everybody just is, just plays chess, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we've talked a lot about opening preparation. In terms of opening prep, there might be a bit of gamesmanship in terms of whether you're in prep or not in prep and trying to like mislead in whichever one it may be.
Yeah, that could be a thing actually, because then of course also when it's opening, it's a weird thing, because when one side is has a deep open preparation, then in a way the game hasn't really started for that person yet. So that person can then just, you know, bang out a move, stand up, and casually walk around. Be still kind of relaxed, I think, in a way. At least that's how I perceive it myself. So in a way, that could be seen as psychological pressure. But I always found it quite hard to play right after you introduce some deep preparation. Actually, not at all easy from a psychological point of view, because then you have to actually show that your preparation worked out, and very often you're not yet fully immersed in the game as your opponent is, because your opponent already started playing much earlier.
Yeah, and just for, I don't know what Craig, the person who sent the question, Craig, I don't know what your experience level is with chess, but I would warn that at the more club level, there's a lot more gamesmanship, I think, actually, because people feel like they can get away with it, and you know, they're counting on the fact their opponent might not have seen all the tricks. So like I just had Stuart Rachels on the show. I am Stuart Rachels, former American prodigy. And
I have his book actually. Very nice.
It's really good. Yeah. Great guy. And he tells one of the stories he tells is, of course, the classic trick where someone makes a move that looks like a blunder. And then as they're getting up from the board, they like, you know, pat their forehead or whatever, or look exasperated, like, oh, how could I do that, when really they're setting some obvious trap. So you won't see like Magnus or Fabiano doing that, but something to be on the lookout for, Craig, in your own games.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I don't think Magnus would ever do such a thing. No.
Yeah, if Magnus does that, he really did blunder.
No, I think the only time I saw Magnus was doing a similar thing was when that famous blunder he made against Vichy in this match.
Yeah.
Where he made a move, he blundered, and he remained stone cold. He didn't give anything away, and Anand made a move, and then he he just sort of collapsed on the table or something and just made sure. I think he made sure there that Anand also knew that he had missed something.
Was that in 2013 or was that?
That was, I think, later, right? It was Sochi, I think.
Okay, I'm going to try to find that game because I don't know that story. So
yeah, it was. He made a king move, and it looked very Anand but actually blundered the game in one move, and it was like a mutual blindness there. The moment Anand played his move, Magnus sort of leaned back his chair and put his head on the table, sort of indicating like, "Wow, I really now escaped." And I think that must have given the message to Anand like, "You just missed a huge chance." Well, at least that's how I perceive that. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but that's how I perceive that. Because why would you otherwise? I mean, there's no.
Yeah. I'll try to track down some footage. That would be fun to see.
Yeah.
So are you okay on timer when I just have a few questions?
Yeah, plenty of time. Sure.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. I read on your Wikipedia page you train with GM Chuchilov. Is that accurate? So for listeners, he's worked with Fabiano Caruana, Anish Giri. What did you learn from him when you were working with him? What was his training style and what was that experience like?
Yeah, he was a real, first of all, he was a very hard worker always. So it was really, you came there, you knew that you came there to work. But that was a good school in that sense. He's opening-minded, so he's good at, and he also likes the deep analysis of opening variations. I think that's why also people like Anish and Fabiano like to work with him because he's creative. He finds ideas. And he has also, I think, in general, a clear idea on how chess should be played at the top level. It's very interesting. I don't know if he's ever been on the show, but you would definitely have a good guest, I think.
Okay.
he's a very interesting character as well when it comes to how he sees the game and perceives the game, etc.
And did you know if his English is good?
Oh, it's definitely good enough for sure. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
He's been working with Caruana for so long, etc. So with Anish, I think with Anish he probably speaks Russian, but I think with Fabiano he definitely spoke English always. So I'm sure that's more than good enough. Absolutely.
Okay, I'll have to try to track him down. One other sort of topic I was interested in, I saw you mentioned going to Shamkir with Giri in an interview, and I know I've seen you when Sagar Shah of Chess Base India was doing the little Anand's famous positions quiz. I believe you made an appearance in that. So how often are you, what I was wondering is how often you were traveling with GM Giri and sort of what the life on the road is like for a second?
Yeah, I generally go to the big tournaments he plays. So when Anish is going somewhere, I'm usually there.
Wow.
And that means being home quite a lot usually. Being away quite a lot usually. And then I also try to play some tournaments myself sometimes. So I actually, my schedule is probably a bit more crowded than Anish's generally when it comes to playing and traveling at least. Okay. But it's fun. I really enjoy it. I like going to all these top events. I think it relates a bit to what I said before about the World Championship match. I mean, these top events, I never quite reached that level myself. But I really enjoy the preparation on that level and helping Anish even if my contribution is small, I still like the idea that I can help him reach a higher level. Of course, for Dutch chess, it's also great that we have, after Uwe and Timon, we have a new contender in our midst.
Yeah.
I'm actually hoping also, if you take it in a broader picture, that it's also going to be great for Dutch chess in the long run.
Well, I'm just impressed with the Dutch chess authors. We've had so many great Dutch chess authors on this show.
It's true, actually. Yeah, you had, of course, Michiel Laban and Willy Hendricks. But we have a history on that. Of course, Timon wrote a lot as well. It's true, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to interview Timon. So Are you working overnight when you help Anish? Like, do you have to keep a different schedule? Are you working one round ahead? What's the meat and potatoes of your work like when you're on the road?
Well, the most extreme things were during the World Championship match, because then, things just have to be worked out to the extreme, basically. So there were nights that I didn't sleep at all, didn't sleep at all.
This is for Topalov?
Okay. I don't know if you remember those times when Topalov had huge issues with the Catalan at a certain point. In that match, and that caused us to spend an entire time, because we had to come up with something new. That was pretty extreme. That's also pretty rough. I'm not even sure I would be able to do that. I mean, it's not like I'm very old now. I'm 35, right. But this is already 10 years ago, and I think it's easy to do for when you're in your teens or in your 20s. It's really quite demanding physically to be skipping nights and still try to work productively. I mean, nowadays with Anish, when he goes to sleep, then I usually continue a bit, but no longer full nights and stuff like that. I just cannot handle it, basically. And I also think it's not always as productive if you go through the entire night. That was what surprised me, actually, from the other... from Michael Alban's book. He spoke about Anand's team, how they actually, even during the months before the tournament, for the match, they would sometimes be sleeping at 6 in the morning or skipping nights. And I thought that was really a very counterproductive way of working, at least to me. I think that breaks all laws of
right.
And also they were eating badly, I believe, from what I fast food. It was a bit surprising to me, because I think if you just have let's say long hours, but let's say from after breakfast till late evening, that's already very productive long hours with good food in between, some walks to freshen the head. I think that's much more normal and productive than
Yeah, sounds much more civilized.
Yeah, but I also think the results will be better.
Yeah.
I really believe so. I don't believe that you can, on weeks on end, work till 4, 5, 6 in the morning and then expect to, a few hours later, stand up again and do that same kind of work. I think it's mind-numbing and it just doesn't work. It is already pretty tough work, because you're for months on end working on openings, basically, and sometimes you're seeing the same position day in, day out, week in, week out. So it can be already pretty mind numbing. And well, the idea to not having normal sleep and it was weird to me. I think the most extreme I ever did was during that match. But then it's, in a way, it's normal, because you just lack the time, the physical time, to fix a certain issue. And I mean, if Topalov has a game the next day at 1:30 or 2, I don't know what the time was anymore, I forgot, then by 9:30 in the morning, he needs to have, after breakfast, he needs to be filled in with a new system, and it simply needs to be ready. So you just cannot go to sleep and then expect, we have to show him something the next day. So that was the most extreme. And during tournaments, we take it a bit more relaxed, because the level of preparation in general is not as high as during a match, so we can take it a bit more. I can take it a bit more easier there.
And what about the candidates with Anish?
Yeah, candidates was also quite extreme, because it's almost as if when the stakes go, stakes get higher, you also tend to work hard. It's still though, I was not skipping nights or something like that. Absolutely not. It's just I don't think it's. But also, I mean, I like to think that it's also important for a second/trainer/coach, however you want to call it, that you make a normal impression towards the person you're with. I mean, we are making walks outside, speaking normal things as well. You're trying to make someone feel comfortable during a tournament, help him after a loss. And I think if you're walking around like a zombie and somebody comes in and he has lost the game, for example, Anis lost the first round against Napo, I don't think it helps if I then walk around like a zombie and barely able to speak normal sentences. I think it's all, you're also there for support, for you know, general help, I think. So
yeah,
I don't think it makes sense to skip the entire night. So of course, I can work a bit along. I can handle a few hours of sleep less every night, but it shouldn't get too extreme, I think.
Gotcha. And your wife, of course, is a strong chess player in her own right and a great photographer. How often is she coming with you traveling so much?
Yeah, my wife's intentional master, and we met through chess, obviously. She's a great photographer, and she has managed to combine the two things she likes, playing chess, traveling, actually three things she likes, traveling, playing chess, and photography. So she travels all over the world, exotic places, pictures them, and publishes it. And that's something she really loves. So she's also she also needed some adjustment this 3 months. I never saw my wife as often as this past three
right, yeah.
Ship tests, by the way, which we passed. So that's all good.
Right.
But she also cannot wait, of course, to start traveling again and play tournaments, photograph, etc. But we're a bit on standby in that sense.
Yeah, aren't we all? Hopefully, at least in Europe. I mean, I think I saw the organizer. Is it Jeroen Berg, the organizer of Wake and Zee?
Yes.
Yeah, he tweeted a picture of a meeting. So maybe you guys.
I think the preparations are in full swing for Wake and Zee. Perhaps some changes will happen. I'm not sure of that. I guess they'll have to take some precautions, but I'm just happy to hear that they at least intend to go forward with the tournament.
Yeah, then that would
be important, I think, for an event with such a tradition that they decide to. And then other events, I think in Biel they are starting, in Netherlands they're trying to hold the Dutch Championship. I think for the next month it's planned.
Oh, okay.
So maybe slowly but surely things are. Are starting, and that would be if it's of course in a responsible way, then it would be a great thing.
Yeah, again, not in the US, unfortunately, but
it's very unfortunate. Exactly.
Yeah,
we're greatly missing the tournaments in St. Louis.
St. Louis
Championship, of course. I don't know when that is planned. The Ziegfeld Cup.
Yeah, I don't even think we can even talk about it the way things are right now.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's very unfortunate because of course chess in America is really. On the rise. It's fantastic to see, actually.
Okay, so Erwin, we're going to bring it back to your course before we let you go. I've been holding a really good question from Patreon supporter and friend of the show, Aaron Holloway Nahum, who is a Carol Con player. So here is what Aaron has to say. Oh, and I remember he tweeted before it was coming out, he was like waking up to see if it was available. So I know he was super excited. And Aaron asks, he says, thanks so much for the amazing course. I've been hugely enjoying the Knight F6 line, which I started playing recently after watching some videos by David Howell. I'm learning a huge amount in the advanced variation. I have two Carol Con questions for you. First, I've always played the Karpov variation, which is 4 and 97 against the main line. Part of me was actually pleased to see it omitted from your course, so less people will be prepared for it now. But I wonder if you could discuss that variation a little bit and let us know why you chose not to cover it. And secondly, I've been considering which line to take myself against the Carol Con. I've enjoyed the advanced variation with h4 and c4 and also the sheer of attack. Which lines would you recommend with white?
Okay, that's interesting. Well, first of all, thanks for the kind words, obviously. The knight d7, I didn't decide to cover knight d7 because of a very simple reason. Actually, I never played it myself. It never appealed to me at all, this move, because it doesn't pressure the knight on e4. And I always felt that critical must be bishop f5 or knight f6, because they're both challenging the knight on e4. And because I thought it's a bit exaggerated to give three alternatives on move 4, I decided to stick with bishop f5, which I've played myself most of my life when I would play the Carol Con. And the most recent trend, which is knight f6, and which is actually the one that's probably going to take over soon as the main line. So for me, knight d7, it never really appealed because it gives white such a free range of options. You're not pressuring the knight on e4. So white has many options after knight d7. And it lost also a little bit of its popularity at the top level, maybe exactly because of that that reason. So that's why I decided actually to stick with bishop f5 and knight f6. And for the second question, which was about which line to play
which
with.
Which line for, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very personal question, of course. I mean, judging by the lines that your viewer mentioned, he chose some very aggressive lines earlier. So I guess stylistically, if you like playing aggressive chess, then for example, an opening variation like the Panov could be interesting, because there you play with an isolated pawn and you try to play for an attack in general. So the Panov could be an interesting system to learn. But those lines that are mentioned in the advanced variation also perfectly reasonable. The Shirov variation with knight c3 is very sharp. Right now, currently, theoretically speaking, black is doing fine everywhere. But yeah, if we're speaking here club level, I think that I don't think it's that important if black is fine at move 20. I think it's more important to choose a line that you feel comfortable with. And once again, judging by the question, probably the viewer prefer, the listener prefers to play very aggressive chess. So then I would recommend him to look for some aggressive systems against the Caracal, like for example the Panov. I think that's an interesting system to choose.
Okay, so there's no one line that's far and away the one that is providing the biggest questions, as Jan Gustafsson would say.
Well, there is certainly one line. I mean, the advanced variation with the so-called short variation with knight f3 right. and bishop e2 versus three bishop f5. That is by far the main line. Recently, on move 4, h4, h5, c4 has taken some momentum. Dubov and Firuzja defeated Artemiev there in Vikingsee this year. So that's also... It's a very trendy variation that that players could try and pick up. But once again, I think that at the club level, you're not really looking for things which are topical at the very highest level. You just try to find a system that you like, that you feel comfortable with, and that you know what you're doing. And that's why I thought that it's best to just look for something that fits your style. I wouldn't therefore recommend you one particular system. I think the Panov for aggressive players would be an interesting choice.
Okay. And I had a philosophical question for you as I was looking through your course. You know, the advanced variation against the Caro has really taken off in the past 20 years, as you mentioned, in terms of especially at the elite level, but not so much the advanced variation against the French, which I considered a bit counterintuitive, since the rap on the French was, of course, the bad light squared bishop on c8. So I was wondering why you think it might be that the advanced against the Caro with the bishop outside the pawn chain, often for black, actually is more testing possibly, or is it just that the winnower is so good against the French that's why people...
For sure, I mean, the advanced variation against the French is also a very valid way of playing for an advantage, but I think recently black has managed to get enough play against d4. So for example, in the Caro Kann, when you play c6 on the first move and d5 on the second move, if white then replies with advanced variation 3 e5, then in order to hit white center, you have to play c6 c5, basically losing a full tempo. And that's the interesting thing. It's one of the lines that I'm actually recommending. It's the move c6, c5 on move 3, where you're actually playing an advanced French, but with the pawn still on e7.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting situation, because the bishop on c8 can now sometimes get out to g4 or to f5. To come back to your question about the French, I think that in the advanced variation, black has just managed to get enough play after... e5, c5, c3, knight c6, bringing the queen to b6, knight often via e7 or h6 to f5, enough play against d4 and b2, which are the two weaknesses there in that line. And that's the reason, I think, of course, in the big advantage for white, I think, in the advanced variation of the Caro Kann, is that it's quite hard to hit the center. You have to lose a full tempo to do it. And that, I think, is the... Yeah, that's the big difference between the two lines. And the fact that the bishop is still on c8 then perhaps plays less of a long-term role.
Okay, so maybe it doesn't fully make up for the lost tempo.
It's very philosophical, because like you said, 10 years from now, theory might have changed. And it might be that actually one line is better than the other. These things are very fluid. Right now, I think that's the current state of affairs, but these things can change.
Yeah, and as your compatriot Willy Hendrix might say, maybe it just comes down to concrete moves. Maybe there is no philosophical reason.
Absolutely. I think that concretely speaking, Black has enough play against d4 pawn in the advanced French, and that's the reason why it. And there were times when it was thought that White was better in advance, and times of Nimzowitsch, for example, he would stick a pawn on e5. And he would say he's already half winning,
right?
But then ways were found to play with c7 c5 to hit the center on d4. And well, nowadays it's not so clear anymore if e4 most likely knight c3 or knight d2 are better moves. In fact,
okay, all right. Well, Erwin, anything else to add? And you've been super generous with your time. The course is available on Chessable. It's on sale for a while longer. Anything else we should? Tell our listeners before we let you go.
I could take this moment to try and plug my course, but I'm very bad at that. I find it such a difficult thing to do to tell to people like, oh, it's so great. I worked on it. I worked so hard on it.
The Carol wins.
Yeah, but I'm trying to avoid at all times. All this refuting the or I don't know. It's just I'm not. I was very objective about things. I worked on it very hard, and I just hope people will appreciate it. That's basically what it comes down to. And I would encourage people to let me know what they thought about the course, because I can learn from that. Maybe they can find some improvements. I will update the course if they do, because theory evolves. So I'm very eager to hear from people what they thought about it. And like I said, I hope they will pick it up, the opening, and play it in their games, have good results, and let me know about it.
Cool. Yeah. And as I told you before we were recording, I don't play it as Black, so I didn't do a full deep dive, but I was definitely impressed with the line you had against my obscure Carol line. So
I had 3 months, so I had plenty of time to
right.
Yeah.
3 months and 2 3,600 engines is a dangerous combination. Okay, well, Erwin, thanks so much. And you're on Twitter. Is there any other social media? I mean, I think you'll be answering questions on Chessable if need be. So is there anywhere else?
In the course, I'm actually constantly monitoring what comes in, and I try to be as helpful as possible. People have questions about move orders, about certain lines. So they can always ask. And I'm on Twitter at @erwinlemie. Very simple, no apostrophes or anything. It's all. I think I have a sleeping Instagram account, so don't even follow that.
Yeah, I can relate.
Yeah, Facebook also has just sleeping. So I think Twitter is it. I believe. Although we have to take care nowadays with this Bitcoin scams.
Oh yeah, it's breaking news. The Twitter hack.
My account hasn't been hacked, so I guess I have. I was not yet a high profile enough person to hack.
Yeah, Anish better watch out though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again, Erwin. This has been great, and I hope you can get back out there to some tournaments soon.
Yeah, I hope so too. Thanks for having me. It was great fun.
Special thanks as always to my producer Matthew Passy, and thanks to those who continue to help spread the word about Perpetual Chess. Positive reviews on podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, glowing comments on YouTube help people discover the show, as does telling a friend or sharing it on social media. Speaking of which, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFischel1, or join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the conversation about the latest interview. Sometimes the guests even weigh into these discussions. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is back in action, so lots of ways to stay engaged, as they say. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those who provide financial support to the show, especially right now with all this COVID craziness going on in the world. Most of all, I want to thank Chessable for sponsoring the show, and to everyone who kicks in via PayPal or the Perpetual Chess Patreon page. I also just put up a little donate directly link on the Perpetual Chess webpage where it says donate. But again, if you're not in a position to donate, I'm happy to have people listening and just enjoying the show. So without further ado, I'd like to give thanks to the people who helped make Perpetual Chess possible. I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Apprentice Chess Twitch channel, Andrew Alhaji, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, The Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chris Flanagan, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Harst, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, James Kennedy, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lucio Casada Silva, the law offices of Stuart Katz, LelaAnalysis.com for cloud-based Lela engine analysis, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, Peter Zodi, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Stephen Martinez, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, Wayne Beam, and I also would like to thank the following: Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Andy Ryerson, FM Andre Terakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Anita Deer, Barry Hessian, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood. I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explain, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dalen Shelton, Dirk Decker, Drake Dominguez, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ethan Smith, Ian Mason, I am Elect, Donnie, Ariel, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letarte-Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schu, Harish Srinivasan, Jacob Kovach, Jack Perry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, JJ Schnod, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM, Josh Friedel, I am Kari Christensen, WGM Katarina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopalakrishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Boyovsky, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Miguel Arispide, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Mulajanov, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbeck, Robert Turner, Roy Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Doherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Shane Unger, Stefan Roller, WGM, Tatiev Abrahamian, Tim Brennan, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyrin Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone. I will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.